Talk a little bit about alternative sources of energy. We'll look a little farther into the future. It's pretty clear that even if further research significantly improves our use of fossil fuels and nuclear energy, we talked yesterday about ways to use coal. And we talked about the improvements on the present way of using nuclear fuels to make them environmentally acceptable. But even granted that we do these things, sooner or later we are going to run out of fossil fuels and uranium. Supply of coal and uranium are certainly very abundant compared with the supplies of oil and gas. But still there's the ethical question, I guess, of whether fuel supplies that were hundreds of million years in the making and are thus not renewable should all be consumed by a few generations of mankind. Undoubtedly, the fossil fuel epic, as future anthropologists may call it, will be a very, very small span within the history of mankind. So whether or not we develop, even if we have, I shouldn't say whether or not, even when we have the technology for using our coal and uranium supplies in an acceptable fashion, well, there's still should be a push toward converting to our renewable supplies of energy. Now, to avoid the use of large numbers, I like to use a unit of energy equal to the U.S. Annual consumption of energy, which is about 6.6 times 10 to the 21st joules, or about 6.5 times 10 to the 18th BTUs. And so we'll call this unit a C for consumption. Now, in these units, the world consumption of energy is about 3.5 C. Now, our known reserves of coal constitute about 125 C. In other words, if we depended on coal only as our sole source of energy, the supply would last for 125 years. Now, of course, the load is going to be divided between different kinds of fuels and energy sources. Our oil reserves and gas reserves each constitute about 5 C. Although there are certainly offshore and unknown deposits that will increase this to some extent, but this is about 5 C of known recoverable reserves of oil and natural gas. Our uranium resources, assuming now a breeder technology, constitute about 115 C. If we don't go to the breeder, why the uranium resources will be very short-lived, just order of 2 to 3 C. But assuming we go to the breeder, uranium constitute about 115 C. These are resources within our own country, not considering import of fuel from other countries. Now, in sharp contrast with this almost is the almost limitless energy which we can derive from thermonuclear fusion or from the never-ending flow of energy from the sun. Other renewable energy sources, of course, include wind power, solar sea power, solar radiance, hydropower, photosynthesis, burning of organic wastes, and and tidal energy. But the two big sources of energy are certainly the thermonuclear fusion and the sun. Estimates of the amount of energy which could be supplied by these renewable resources are as follows. Solar radiation could supply 740 C. Wind power could supply 5 C. Sea thermal gradients could supply 6 C. Hydropower is just about largely saturated now at about 0.1400ths of a C, 0.14 C. Tidal power, if harnessed, could supply about a tenth of a C. Geothermal steam power could supply 0.2 C. So the certainly the big candidates are solar radiation and thermonuclear fusion. And those of you who have looked at the summary of the National Plan for Energy Research and Development realize that thermonuclear fusion now and the development of solar power, along with the breeder reactor, receive the chief emphasis for research and development for energy sources for the long term. And incidentally, if some of you weren't here yesterday, I have some copies of that I've sort of, they're not easy to read because I've cut and pasted, and they're photocopies of photocopies of photocopies. But anyway, they give a summary of the Energy Research and Development Association's new National Plan for Energy Research and Development, which was just in the last weeks submitted to the Congress and will undoubtedly be the basis for a great deal of discussion in the coming months or coming weeks. Well, since we have quite recently talked about nuclear fission, let's talk just a bit about thermonuclear fusion then. I suppose you could say this is probably the oldest known source of energy, since the sun and all the stars in the heavens have made use of thermonuclear fusion for a good many years, but it's only in recent years that man has had within his reach means for converting this almost limitless source of energy to something that will do his daily work, will fit his needs. Let me just review again what is involved in nuclear fission, and we'll extend this to fusion. In nuclear fission, the heavy nuclei of elements, isotopes of uranium or the man-made elements of plutonium are split up. They, by capture of a neutron, they become unstable and split up into several smaller nuclei and release an enormous amount of energy in the process. Also an enormous amount of radioactive garbage, which of course is one of the problems we talked about yesterday. In the thermonuclear fusion, just the opposite happens. Two nuclei of very light elements fuse together and form a slightly heavier nucleus, and again release an enormous amount of energy. Now the elements that fuse will, in any kind of a practical fusion reactor, will almost certainly be isotopes of hydrogen. Hydrogen, to review something you may have heard in a chemistry or physics class some years ago, hydrogen has three isotopes. The common hydrogen has the nucleus consists of a proton with electron orbiting about it or surrounding it. In a heavier version called deuterium, the nucleus contains a proton plus a neutron, and therefore its mass is twice that of normal hydrogen. The third rather rare isotope of hydrogen is has a proton and two neutrons. It's referred to as tritium. Seawater contains, or any kind of normal water contains a balance between normal hydrogen and the heavier isotopes. The heavier isotopes, of course, are exist in very small proportions, but nonetheless, there is a lot of deuterium and tritium in seawater, and that's the reason that we talk about thermonuclear fusion as being an almost limitless resource, because literally we would be taking our fuel from seawater, and it would take millions of years really to deplete the supply of deuterium in the sea. Tritium is that has special problems. I may come back to that. Since tritium is a very radioactive material, it requires special handling and so on. Now, if it's so simple, why is it so hard? Well, the whole thing is that in the fission process, the nucleus absorbs a neutron, which is easy to do because the neutron is a neutral particle, and therefore there's no electric force to overcome. With the fusion of two nuclei to form a heavier nucleus, you have to overcome a tremendous electric potential barrier, the physicists call it. That is, as you probably remember, like charges repel each other, and the force of the repulsion between them goes inversely as the square of the distance between them. Well, this isn't so serious until you start to talk about getting nuclei within one nuclear diameter of each other so that they can fuse. And then, of course, you're talking about exceedingly small distances, 10 to the minus 15th meters. And so the electric forces become very, very large. So this means that the two nuclei that are to fuse have to approach each other with a very large amount of kinetic energy in order that they can penetrate this strong electric force that's pushing them apart. Well, in the laboratory, you get two nuclei to fuse by accelerating one of them in some kind of a particle accelerator and firing at a target of the other type. But this gives you one event, you know, it gives you a few events. In a reactor, you've got to have many events. Furthermore, you've got to expend less energy in getting these nuclei to fuse with each other than you get out of the fusion process itself. Otherwise, you don't produce energy, you just consume energy. In the sun, energy that forces these nuclei together at very, very high energy is supplied by the enormous gravitational field of the sun. In any kind of a reactor that we would build, we obviously aren't going to make it as big as the sun, and we don't have that advantage. We have to supply the containment forces by other means. Now, this means that in even the easiest fusion reaction to bring about is the fusion of one nucleus of deuterium, heavy hydrogen, and one nucleus of super heavy hydrogen, tritium. And even this deuterium-tritium reaction, or DT reaction as we'll refer to it, requires a great deal of energy. If we try to translate it into temperatures and pressures, it requires something like 100 million degrees of temperature and pressures of several thousand atmospheres. Well, how do we hope to ever bring those about in a fusion reactor? Well, the getting the energy into the particles is not the most serious problem, but preventing the constant loss of energy and also containing the particles is is the crux of the technological problem. Now, the containment is something that has been under study during the last 20 or 30 years, and the problems have been just horrendous, but the end appears to be in sight now. Ever since the detonation, of course, of the hydrogen bomb in the early post-World War II years, scientists have worked very, very diligently, but at a, well, I should say a slow, but a diligent, steady pace on the problem of how to contain a completely ionized plasma. When you begin to talk about temperatures of million degrees, you don't have molecules, certainly. You don't have atoms, even. At these temperatures, you have just an ionized plasma consisting of bare nuclei and free electrons. And the way one contains a plasma like this is to use a properly designed magnetic field. Because, as again, let me review with you a little bit of elementary physics. You remember that charged particles moving in a magnetic field experience a force. That's the principle that gives rise to any kind of an electric generator, isn't it? And so if you could shape the magnetic field in a very clever fashion, why, you could design it so that the particles were always turned back and forced back inward into the plasma. And this is, in fact, what's been done. There are two basic ways that one confines a plasma, either an open containment or a closed containment system. And we'll talk about this more in just a bit when we talk about fusion devices. In the first diagram we use a magnetic coils in such a way that there's a magnetic field gradient. And so the red represents plasma particles. Now, some of you are close enough to read the caption, some of you aren't. But the magnetic field is more concentrated at the ends of this so-called magnetic mirror device, and less so at the center, so that particles that approach the ends of the magnetic field spiral around in a faster, a tighter and tighter helix, and are reflected back and forth. So envision, if you can, plasma particles moving back and forth. Now, this actually is very much like the radiation belts around the Earth. If any of you are familiar with the Van Allen radiation belts that occur around the Earth, charged particles that come from the sun or from cosmic origin circulate back and forth along the magnetic lines of the Earth, and the mirror regions, in the case of the Earth, are the polar regions toward the North and South Pole. And so the Earth magnetic field has contained plasma particles like this for many years. But it's only recently that man has learned to do it. The other way of doing it is to not worry about the ends at all by using a closed magnetic configuration and applying a field such that the plasma particles just circulate around in a donut. Well, this is as you could really surmise, I'm sure, is an oversimplification of the real problem. The gross containment of a plasma isn't quite so difficult, but one gets all sorts of instabilities. That is, in a place where the charged particles tend to collect, then you get a distortion of the magnetic field, and that tends to collect more particles there and distort it some more, and pretty soon you've got a leak. It's sort of like trying to squeeze a balloon, you know. If you squeeze too hard and you don't have your fingers right together, then all of a sudden you get a blister popping out in one place, and you lose all the particles. So the history of research on the controlled thermonuclear reactor project has really been a history of discovering and trying to cope with all these magnetic instabilities and all these things that have developed. It's been it's seeming at times almost like a unending struggle. Every time you cross one hill and think that you're over the top, why then another hill looms ahead of you. But in the process, a whole new science of dealing with plasma physics has grown up, and now it's really grown to maturity, and we can with some confidence say that we understand how to handle fully ionized plasmas, and we can start to talk about the time schedule for thermonuclear power. Now, the one of the problems, another problem, of course, is that even when you think you understand plasma devices, the one will never get a self-sustaining plasma, or that is a device that produces more energy than it consumes till you get to a certain size. Because the rate of energy loss of a plasma, and this is true, of course, of a hot ball or anything else, depends upon the surface area, because you're constantly losing energy across the surface. Whereas the rate at which you can generate energy depends upon the volume of the plasma. Well, if you remember your geometry, you remember that, say, for a simple sphere, the surface area goes up as the square of the radius, but the volume goes up as the cube of the radius. And this is true, of course, of any other irregular shape, too, that the volume to surface ratio gets bigger the device gets. So we introduced the idea of scaling. And one has to get to a certain size of device before there's any hope of generating more energy than you consume in keeping the device working. But when you start to talk about large devices, then I'm not sure exactly how the cost of a device like this scales, but that must be at least with the third or fourth power of the size of it. And so one gets to a certain point where you say, well, I've gone as far as I can now with the laboratory device. I've got to build a large scale experimental device, and then you build that and get it working, and you say, okay, the next step is to build a still larger device, and you just the project just sort of goes up by steps, and at some point you say, we've got to commit ourselves now, and we've got faith that the thing is going to work, and we've got to go ahead and build a large pilot plant device. And that's just about the stage where we are now. The IRDA has requested funds, and I'm quite confident they'll be approved to go ahead and build a large pilot plant size reactor. It's proposed that this will be built at the Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory, and if all goes well, it could be operating by 1980 or very soon thereafter. The plan, at least now, is that the target is to have an operating device of commercial size by the end of the 1990s. Now, this will require, of course, the building of several intermediate reactors of fairly large size and fairly high cost, both in the amount of scientific effort and manpower that needs to go into them, as well as the amount of cost of building these devices. But most scientists, I think, now that connected with the thermonuclear reactor project are fairly confident that it will, in fact, come into reality. And because the stakes are so large here, I think that our national interests would best be served if we go full speed ahead on something like this. Well, let me just... Yes, please, please.
I assume you're at the end of that. Are there any other countries that are doing research in this area?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. In fact, the U.S. has lagged. It's and you'll find this in my commenting on several of these alternative forms of energy. We have tended to lag behind on research and development on certain advanced types of energy conversion. The Soviet Union has put a larger amount of effort into thermonuclear fusion than we have for the last decade or so. If we go ahead with the our plans, present plans, why I think we'll certainly catch up with them in size of effort. One of the most pleasing things, and I have not been affiliated with the CTR program for more than about a year myself, but one of the very pleasing things in extensive reading I've been doing about this is degree of international cooperation. This is one place now where there's been almost no withholding of information. And in retrospect, probably the wisest thing we ever did was to declassify all the thermonuclear energy data back in the early 1960s. Because the device now that I'm going to, well, let me just go on here to the, I guess this is kind of a little more detail than we care to go into, but this device that at least at the present time, there are several different schemes for bringing about building thermonuclear reactors, but the one that seems to be at this point at least head and shoulders above all the others, and certainly the first reactors will be built using a scheme that scientists call a tokamak, which is really an acronym for three Russian words. And it, you know, sort of points out the fact that the big breakthrough came at the Moscow laboratory of the Russian Academy of Science. The tokamak concept was really invented by Russian physicist Artsimovich and his colleagues, and in fact there's a lot of interesting stories in connection with this, because when Artsimovich first announced the results, some of the results of the their tokamak experiments, there were a lot of people that didn't believe it. Yeah, a lot of people in the West, because at that time our work with plasma containment was beginning to look mighty hopeless, and confinement time and the density of plasma data that that group announced were accepted with some skepticism in this country. In fact, Artsimovich invited anybody that wanted, that didn't believe him, to come over and run his tokamak themselves. And there was, in fact, a group of British plasma physicists that spent a considerable amount of time in Russia and working with this. And after it was established that this the results were, in fact, as good as they looked, why, we immediately set about constructing tokamak in this country. In fact, we converted one of the stellarator machines, the one at Princeton, to a tokamak operation. And so of the three or four different configurations for thermonuclear reactors, the tokamak concept is certainly the front runner. Now, there's also a big consortium of Western European countries that have cooperated on building thermonuclear reactors. It's really a subdivision of Euratom, and they've done a lot of work on it. The Japanese are pushing very hard on thermonuclear energy. Of course, Japan is in worse straits with the with the energy crisis than we are, since they've Japan has very little native fuel resources, and almost all of their energy is imported.
The long period of time that's elapsed that we've tried to develop a national energy policy affected the speed with which the thermonuclear work is going on?
Well, first of all, let me just correct. In my opinion, at least, there really hasn't been a long period of time in developing a national energy policy. We didn't really start till a few weeks ago, you know, or a few months ago. As far as the time scale of thermonuclear research, it's been very, very slow. It's been up until about 2 years ago, the whole research and development program on thermonuclear energy was funded at about a constant $30 million a year. Now, in some ways, this has been good because it's given plasma physicists lots of time to think, and it's proceeded at a rather slow rate. But in terms of our energy needs, this has been very, very bad. It could certainly have proceeded at a much faster pace. But it wasn't till 2 years ago that there was any sizable increase in the effort at all. It was just a couple of three laboratories with a few dozens of people working on the whole thing.
This is a cost-benefits thing, though. I don't want to argue with you, but I don't think you could be overly critical when we have a seeming abundance of coal.
Well, it doesn't seem that way to me, though, you see. Seeming abundance is kind of, it's a matter of how you view it.
Aren't you talking about different time frames? We have an abundance of coal at this time, but by the time the technology that you're talking about is going to be commercialized, it seems to me coal might not be there.
We'll have a lesser abundance.
Yeah.
And but that's all I was trying to put in perspective, is that if you've got, well, we're enjoying a renewable resource here, I suppose you could have some more efficient way of doing things, and you use what you have available to you at the time,
yeah,
based on what the cost benefit
is. Yeah. Now, well, of course, wood and coal are quite different. Wood is renewable.
Right.
Coal is not. So the fossil fuels are not. It takes millions of years to make coal. It only takes 50 years to make a tree.
Yeah.
And when you were talking about like 100 C or 115 C that our coal supply is good for, now is that taking into consideration the expanding amount of energy?
No,
staying at where we are right now.
The C unit is in terms of current energy consumption.
Well,
because
right
you don't
now,
know
what is our percentage of expanding energy we're using per year?
Well, the present rate of expansion is about 4%. Now, I'm fairly confident that that's going to level off somewhat. I don't think that we are the year we'll go to zero energy growth is in sight yet. I think still there will still be a rate of increase.
No, I'm climbing faster myself.
Well,
the way things are going.
I hope that, and I guess I have enough confidence in the American people to think that that we're not going to continue to just go on. Increasing our appetite. I think it will take a while to spread the word and to get people really thinking energy conservation in a big way. And in fact, that's going to be our theme tomorrow, is going to be energy conservation, because all this, in my opinion at least, all the talk here about alternative forms of energy and developing new forms of energy becomes rather meaningless if we don't, at some place, put a lid on our energy usage. Now, Al Pitcher, in his series last week, some of you that may have heard of him, advocated an immediate flattening of the curve. We just ought to take, you know, very, very drastic means to go to zero energy growth immediately. But I really don't see this in the cards. I think that it would create horrendous problems, economic problems and social problems and everything else. But I certainly want to see the curve level off as soon as possible. It's sort of a little bit like the population growth problem, which, you know, 3 or 5 years ago, we were still on an exponential rise in population. And public responded very, very fast. Now, there's a lot more to that problem. I don't know that the birth rate has dropped suddenly just because people were becoming concerned about overpopulation. I think there are a lot of other reasons why the birth rate has dropped. But at least there was a response that was a lot faster than most people expected. Now, I hope that there'll be the same kind of a response to the energy situation, that once people get the word and begin to realize, but it's a rather small group of percentage of the population that's as yet is concerned or informed about what is really the situation with regard to our natural resources.
Price is doing it, isn't it?
Pardon?
Price is doing it.
You would expect it would, but it doesn't seem to. And I'm not sure how much higher the price of. So, well, the only thing that's really increased in price is gasoline. Electricity has not increased. Yeah, but it's minuscule.
Well,
but even
they say
gasoline.
That they killed the strip mining bill by energy, traditional energy source lobby. Hitting the congressman was the fact that you were going to have very high energy costs, mainly electricity. And this evidently meant something to those congressmen, especially if we're going on these boats and something. Mm-hmm. So, and if you get an electric bill of $200 a month for an all-electric house in Vermont, I think you soon realize. And this is what happens.
My own feeling is that electricity would have to go up at least 3 or 4 times in cost before there'd be any appreciable decrease in its use. But that I may be wrong. It maybe a doubling would actually decrease it. But certainly the doubling of gasoline price hasn't made any appreciable dent in the rate of consumption. We're consuming just about as much now at with a 60-cent gas as we consume the 30-cent gas. I don't know how much higher it's going to have to go before there'll be
three times as probably.
Possibly. Yeah.
It's accelerated the use of small cars, though, which is
well, hasn't really. It for a moment it did. Now, right after the gas shortage or the pump dry up last a year or so ago, there was a swing towards small cars. But now it looks like people are swinging back to big cars again.
Well, everything I've read indicated that the foreign models are still increasing the market share on a month-by-month basis, with the exception of the Cadillacs and the Lincolns, mm-hmm. who still seem to be selling quite
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
But it has also made the bigger cars go to revamping them, so knocking down the power, but their mileage is increasing. I mean, we don't have the big cars now that are getting like 6 and 7 miles per gallon with the high performances in them. Now they're working up there to 16, 17 miles per gallon in 75s.
Well,
they have done that.
I'm not aware that there's been that much of a change.
That's what they're advertising now. And
yeah.
I know back then, you know, back when 2 years ago when I was a kid, we were running around these big high performance cars. You get 7, 8 miles gallon, you're really doing good.
Yeah. No, they're at some point we're going to see a dramatic decrease in the use of gasoline. But as yet, there hasn't been much. So I just don't know.
More likely it would be shortage than right.
Possibly. Right. Possibly. But at some point. Well, let me just go through a little bit for those of you who are interested in this is the design parameters of the tokamaks, sort of an answer to your question, that are operating around the world. The our largest machine in this country is the so-called PLT, the Princeton Large Torus at the Princeton Labs, and this is about the same size as the T10 at in Russia. We're proposing now, of course, to build a two-component tokamak, as it's going to be called, that will go on in operation if all goes well by about 1980. This is a artist's view of a proposed fusion power plant of the tokamak variety. About 2 years ago, the AEC, as it was then, the forerunner of IRDA, asked about four or five different groups that had done a lot of research on fusion devices and were knowledgeable in this area to sit down and actually design reactors on paper, and so that one might make some estimates of how much heavy materials, just the amount of things, rather exotic materials like niobium that would have to go into reactors is a source of some concern, or lithium for the blanketing is a source of some concern, because it might mean a fourfold increase in production of some of these materials and things. Here, in answer to your question, is a breakdown now of the man years of scientific work and engineering work that have gone into the thermonuclear reactor project. It's given here for 1963 and 1971. And you see that still the USSR has the greatest effort in this area, but if we go through the present national plan, why, we'll step up our effort in this area considerably in the next 2 or 3 years.
What's the end product of the tokamak?
The end product really is, well, it's heat, but it's mostly in the form of fast neutrons. And this is the reason I didn't go into the details of the construction, but see, the thermonuclear reaction gives you basically two byproducts. It gives you a 14 MeV neutron, and it gives you an alpha particle, a charged helium nucleus that carries off about 1 MeV. Now, the helium particle, of course, is very easy to convert. In fact, that can be converted directly to electricity in some kind of a magnetohydrodynamic system, because it already carries a charge. The energy of the neutron has to be somehow converted to something else. Now, the one way to do this, or the way that's usually proposed, is to let the neutron interact with a lithium nucleus and produce a high-energy proton plus heat. And so the plasma core would be probably surrounded by a lithium blanket. Now, there's two reasons for using lithium. One is in that it captures neutrons and converts the neutron energy to thermal energy rather readily. The second is that lithium interacts with the neutron to form tritium. And since tritium, it is a rather scarce material, it's difficult to separate from seawater. Once we've established an initial inventory of tritium, why, you want to run your reactors in such a way that they keep producing tritium at the same rate that they use it up. So the lithium blanketing both converts neutron energy to heat and also produces tritium.
I guess what I was really asking was, now, can this be transported?
Well, this is heat now that you can use same way you use heat from any kind of a boiler. Mm-hmm. The first generation of CTR will certainly employ some kind of a fluid that is vaporized and drives a turbine, either water or some higher temperature fluid that will drive a turbine generator. Now, later ones would probably use more exotic means of conversion of thermal energy to electrical power, such as the magnetohydrodynamic generator.
Well, this is the power source, and it generates the power source.
Right.
You'd have to have a power unit like this at any place that you were generating power.
Right. It's a reactor. It's like a fission reactor.
I see.
You use the nuclear reaction to produce heat, and this is converted into. Another scheme that is quite different from the magnetic containment of a plasma, some of you may have heard of, is the, as it's sometimes called, a popularly laser zap fusion. What is necessary, of course, is to get this astronomical temperature and pressure to exist for a long enough time so at least some of the nuclei can fuse. Now, in the magnetic containment, you try to make this containment time be what on a nuclear time scale is very long, at least fractions of a second. Then you select a semi-modest, at least, if you can call 100 million degrees modest, temperature and pressure. Now, in the laser fusion scheme, you make the containment time exceedingly short, of the order of millionths of a second. But then you make the density and the of the charged particles, that is the temperature and the pressure, very, very much higher so that you still get fusion. And the way this is proposed is to shine very, very high energy content laser light in from all directions and shock compress the little pellets of solid deuterium and tritium, and so that you literally produce little microscopic hydrogen bombs, I guess you'd call them. You explode these pellets as you hit them with a pulse of laser light. Now this laser fusion is somewhat farther behind in the development scheme than magnetic containment of plasmas in a conventional, they call it conventional device. But some people have great hopes for this scheme, and recently now we've started a parallel effort on laser-induced fusion.
What kind of materials are you talking about when you're talking about the high temperatures?
You mean in the plasma or in
the construction of the facility?
Okay. A plasma device, as I mentioned, said the containment of the plasma is done by the magnetic field, and because of course no material, by definition, could stand millions of degrees at that temperature. All materials are in the plasma state. So the magnetic field has to do the primary containment, but nonetheless there'd be a leakage of charged particles, and there'll be neutrons coming out, of course, in copious abundance. There'll be X radiation, so you have to have material that can be vacuum tight and still can stand pretty high temperatures. Well, the paper designs now, most of them used things like niobium or vanadium for the first vacuum wall. I think one or two groups used stainless steel, but this means that you have to operate at a considerably lower temperature to use stainless, and also there's a problem using a lithium blanket with stainless steel. Lithium attacks stainless steel, but there are other problems with using the heavy refractory metals like niobium, vanadium, tungsten, things. In fact, that happens to be the phase of the problem that I've been most concerned with in the research that I'm doing at Argonne, is the interaction of very intense beams of charged particles and neutrons with a variety of materials. We think we have made at least a minor breakthrough in the use of sintered metals. But, that's quite another story. That's one of the myriad technological details that have to that have to go into something like this. There's just a horrendous amount of technology that has to go into this.
What does the C stand for in CGR?
Controlled thermonuclear reactor, as opposed to an uncontrolled thermonuclear reactor, which is a hydrogen bomb. Yeah. Well, one last slide here of a proposed fusion-fission hybrid, where one of the things you produce is a tremendous quantity of fast neutrons, and in fact, I feel, at least, and a number of people certainly feel this way, that a small fusion reactor, one that's even too small to produce power, one that consumes slightly more power than it produces, still could be very, very useful in the energy scheme as a breeder. All you need to breed nuclear fuel, fission fuel that is a source of fast neutrons. Now, ordinarily you'd get this by operating a fission reactor, but as you know, the fast breeder reactors have run into some pretty nasty problems, the sodium-cooled ones and the gas-cooled ones. And there are a lot of these problems that could be avoided by building a fusion, small fusion reactor to supply the neutrons to breed fissile fuel. For example, one thing that you can do with a fusion neutron, since they're somewhat higher energy than fission neutrons, is that you can breed thorium. You can go to a different cycle. You can, instead of breeding plutonium from uranium-238, you can breed U-233, which is fissionable, from thorium. And the resource, the mineral content of thorium is even higher than uranium. It's a very, very abundant material. And you could breed uranium-233 and avoid some of the fears of having of producing large stores of plutonium, both from the standpoint of U-233 is not nearly as toxic as plutonium, and furthermore, it's easy to mix in enough U-238 so that nobody could possibly make a bomb out of it. So I think there's a lot of promise in this approach to breeding, for instance. Well, what about the sun? We ought to talk about the sun a bit. since it is potentially, you can't overlook this 470 C of energy every year that we receive from the sun. There are basically three ways in which the enormous energy of the sun can be utilized. One is through a solar thermal system, where you use the sun to produce heat. And then this heat is used for space heating or process heat or even cooling or even the production of electrical power. Anytime you have heat, of course, you can run a boiler, and a boiler can generate steam to run a turbine generator. Second way by the direct photovoltaic generation of electricity, where you convert not the heat of the sun, but the light of the sun directly to electricity in some kind of a solid-state device, a silicon solar cell or gallium arsenide or cadmium sulfide or some kind of a solar cell, like you're familiar with from the use of the solar generators that were put on our most of our orbiting space satellites. And the third way, of course, is the indirect use of sunlight by solar sea power or wind power. Of course, is directly is really solar power or bioconversion, using the sun's light to make wood or methane or other things that are produced indirectly from sunlight. Now, undoubtedly, the first significant use of solar power will be for heating and cooling homes and commercial buildings, and for certain types of process heat. The simplest solar collector for space heating is just simply a black surface with several, one or more panes of glass covering it in order to reduce heat loss. The glass, of course, transmits the sunlight, but it absorbs the re-radiated heat from the hot collecting surface and gives you a what's sometimes called a greenhouse effect. If you use selective optical coatings on the glass, you can enhance the efficiency of such a collector, but for small systems, they're probably not necessary. Let me just remind you again of the, which you perhaps learned some years ago, about black body radiation or radiation of energy from hot surfaces, because it's very important in understanding these solar devices. Any body, us or the even a snowbank or anything, radiates heat. And the heat that's radiated has a distribution of wavelengths that depends upon its temperature. The higher the temperature, the more radiation is emitted at short wavelengths until you get to a certain point where things become incandescent. That is, they radiate a lot of energy of a wavelength that's so short that we receive it as light. So really the only difference between heat radiation and light radiation or radio waves or any kind of electromagnetic radiation is the wavelength. So a hot body like the sun now will have a distribution of radiation, if we call this wavelength and call this the radiation. And some of you that are into photography in a big way, of course, know that when you buy a color film, you always have to match the color temperature of the film, that is the wavelength to which it's most sensitive, to the particular type of light that you're using. If you buy outdoor film and you, which is balanced for the radiation distribution of sunlight, the surface of the sun is about at 5,000 degrees Kelvin, 5,000 degrees period, I guess, when you get to that temperature, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about centigrade or Kelvin. Whereas an incandescent light is balanced to a lower temperature, so it has a different distribution of light. Well, a hot surface, a hot solar collector, say operating at 100 or 200 degrees, will have its, and we can now hear somewhere, a much longer wavelength. It's not wavelengths to which the eye responds. It's just heat waves, infrared. So. Now glass probably has a transmission that looks, it transmits fairly well up here, and then it just sort of falls off and get out in the infrared, so that sunlight gets through nicely, but it tends to absorb heat radiation in the infrared. Now if you want to go to, if you want to get maximum efficiency, then you apply some kind of an optical coating to this glass so that it comes and cuts off very, very sharply. And you can increase the efficiency there quite a bit this way. Well, solar air conditioners are under development, although at this time I don't know of any commercial units. I expect that some companies will have them on the market fairly soon. One prototype system uses the ammonium cycle, very much like the Servel Electrolux type of refrigerators, you know, the gas-operated refrigerators, where the ammonia is separated from the water by the use of solar heat, and then it's condensed and re-evaporated in the refrigeration cycle. Now, such refrigerators require fairly high temperatures, at least 120 to 130 degrees C, and so the collectors that you'd have to use for them are slightly more sophisticated than you'd need for space heating. But the nice thing about, or the one of the real incentives for solar air conditioners is that the time when they would be most effective, namely in the summer when there's direct sunlight, is the time which electrical power is scarcest on a hot day in the sun in the summer. An obvious problem for solar heating and cooling is the storage of energy at night or on cloudy days, and various schemes have mentioned using hot rocks or hot water or even some kind of a chemical system that undergoes a phase change, melts at a fairly high temperature or vaporizes or something of that sort. One of the interesting schemes I recently heard discussed was for home use at least, was a solar salt pond. You build yourself a swimming pool in the backyard, and you heat it all summer from the sunlight. You paint the bottom black, and you absorb sunlight all summer and produce hot water, and then you store this for winter use. Now, an ordinary swimming pool, of course, would cool off fairly rapidly, because when the surface of the water, when the air cooled and the surface of the water was cooled, you'd start to set up convection currents in the pool. And so the hot water at the bottom would soon come up to the surface and would cool off. But now if you add a gradient of salt into this pool, you introduce some salt at the bottom so that salinity is higher, and therefore the density of the water at the bottom is higher. And you do this such that you just balance this differential in temperature, why you can get almost complete stagnation of the water. And calculations show that with a pool 6 or 8 or 9 feet deep, depending upon how cold your climate is, why you could have water just below the boiling point at the top, and same time that you've got ice at the bottom, the same time you've got ice at the top by a salt gradient like this. You can store a tremendous amount of energy this way. From somewhere.
Is that a heat sink?
Pardon?
Heat sink? You know, is there a popular name for it?
Well, the only thing I've ever heard it called is just a solar salt pond.
Well, the fact that you've got a higher concentration of salt then keeps the heated water from rising. It is
keeps convection current. Yeah.
Yeah. Water expands as it heats.
Well, it reaches water. Yeah. Water expands both directions from 4 degrees centigrade.
Yeah.
And now, of course, you'd have to have the amount of salt you have to add is actually very, very small. And you'd have to add, just a few salt blocks in the bottom, and you might have to add just a little bit of fresh water at the top, just to keep the gradient perfectly balanced. But it would be a fairly simple system.
No swimming in that pool.
No swimming in that pool, however. No, you can't stir it up. Clothes dryers and water heaters seem to me like just natural candidates for solar power. If I were in the home appliance business, or if I had any designs as an inventor or as an entrepreneur, I'd be rushing to put solar water heaters and clothes dryers on the market. Because when electricity doubles or triples, and natural gas goes almost out of sight, as everyone, I think, expects it will, it's just a matter of when, why such appliances could be tremendously popular. See, the thing that is the most natural candidate for solar energy immediately, without very much new technology at all, is low-grade heat. It's very hard to get to high-grade energy. electricity. That requires a lot of technology. But low-grade process heat, like there are beginning to be solar grain dryers on the market, and solar clothes dryers, solar water heaters, these things that just require low-grade process heat, just seem to me like naturals. We could introduce them into the marketplace without any real technology advance at all. It's anyone's guess as to whether the backyard clothesline will regain its popularity again. There are disadvantages, of course. There, in having to actually go out and hang up all the clothes and take them down. But a solar-powered clothes dryer is another thing. You can still take the clothes right out of the washer and pop in the dryer, but instead of turning the gas on or turning the electricity on, you turn on the hot air from the roof or wherever. Conversion of solar energy into electricity, of course, is a more difficult problem, because you've got to collect, if you're going to talk about a large central power station, then you've got to collect and concentrate a tremendously large amount of solar energy. Now, there are two very large study projects study and hard work building projects that I know of in the country, and quite a few more smaller ones. The big ones are down at the University of Arizona, and then at Minnesota. The Minneapolis Honeywell and University of Minnesota have a fairly large project on using solar collectors, concentrating this energy on many, many, many feet of heat pipes and what you might call them linear boilers, and producing hot water this way that would be sufficient to drive large turbines. The Arizona project is a little bit different in that they are using a molten salt as the heat storage and transfer element, and trying to operate at a higher temperature and therefore higher efficiency, so that they'll need fewer acres or square miles of solar collectors. But there are some technological problems with going to a molten salt system like this. The farther in the future are the photovoltaic devices, that is the solar cells that would directly convert solar energy into electricity. The most efficient material, certainly for solar cells, is silicon. But here it's a matter of cost, and there are the people that feel that if there were a market for producing silicon by the square yard now instead of by the square inch, the price would go down drastically, dozens of times. And this remains to be seen, of course. Right now, it's just out of reason. Electricity from silicon cells would be 500 to 1,000 times more expensive than electricity that we produce. And you can afford this up in the satellite, where you have no other choice, but you can't afford to talk about it as a commercial venture at this time. But silicon technology certainly needs to be developed. The efficiency of silicon cells has just in a few years been pushed up from something like 7 or 8% to something approaching 20% under ideal laboratory conditions. That probably it would be difficult to push it any higher than 20%, but if you can get the cost of producing of growing silicon in very large quantities down, why it may not, photovoltaic conversion may not be as far off as we think. There are, of course, other materials. The cheapest material right now for solar cells is cadmium sulfide. But cadmium sulfide is not a particularly stable material. It has to be, it certainly has to be encased in glass or plastic or something like that. It's not a very stable material. It's not as desirable as silicon. Gallium arsenide is another one. Some of you that follow the stock market, know what happened here about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Varian Associates announced a gallium arsenide diode that achieved a higher conversion efficiency under laboratory conditions than any previous gallium arsenide cells. And their stock immediately jumped by about 50%. And Varian's a big company. There's a lot of stock. There's a lot of stock in the market. That's a tremendous amount of a tremendous number of millions of dollars right there. And Varian didn't really, I don't think, consider it as a major breakthrough, but just anything that's announced these days that's supposed to be a breakthrough in solar power has quite an effect on the marketplace. It's almost like the 60s, you know, when everybody was starting a company that had a computer in its name and selling stock practically on the street corner to everybody. So I hope that solar energy doesn't become the patent medicine of the decade, because this could give the whole, this could result in a somewhat of a setback for the whole thing.
Can you make any general statement about overall economics of thermonuclear versus perhaps the more simple form of solar energy?
It's
a difficult thing, but is one going to be astronomically more expensive than the other, or can't anything really just be said yet?
Well, solar, it depends so much on whether you're talking about process heat or electricity.
I guess I'm thinking in kilowatts.
Yeah, for the production of electricity right now, solar energy looks terribly expensive. It's going to have to come down in cost many times over, because now a thermal converter is definitely going to be a low efficiency device. You just can't operate. You can't talk about solar boilers, operated boilers, more than 100, 200 degrees. It'd be just too horrendous to try to operate miles and miles of steam pipe at real high pressures. So the solar thermal converter is going to be a fairly low efficiency device. Furthermore, you've got a lot of hardware. The photovoltaic thing is very expensive right now. Even if silicon cells come down in cost 50-fold, it's still going to be very expensive. So that solar generated electricity is not going to be cheap by any means. Now, but solar process heat, that's quite a different thing. If you don't need, if you only need hot air at 80 degrees to dry corn, that's cheap, that's easy to come by. Or if you only need hot water at 80 degrees less than that, 40, 50 or 60 degrees for home usage, that's cheap, that's easy to come by.
And probably cheaper than the same need served by thermonuclear devices.
Oh yeah, well, thermonuclear is just the opposite. They're the only reasonable thing to produce and distribute is electricity. And of course I just feel that electricity has to pass out of the process heat and space heating use immediately. I just can't understand why we haven't taken some action on this differential electricity rate business. The fact that a person who uses electricity inefficiently to heat his house pays only a third as much, between a third and a half as much for the electricity as somebody who uses it only for more efficient things such as heat, such as lighting and power.
Don't you foresee some federal regulations changing this? I mean, commercial.
But I have for a good many years, and they haven't come about.
I think one of the states has adopted, one of the utilities in
one of the New England states has adopted a retrogressive.
Yeah, well, you don't even have to go to a retrogressive if they just eliminate the incentive.
Just
a flat rate. Now, I feel very sorry for the people who have been duped into building a gold medallion all-electric house. I feel sorry for them because they've been sold a bill of goods. They've been told big fat fibs, you know, about the availability of electricity, and it's going to go hard on them.
Isn't that perhaps one of the reasons that it hasn't been done?
Yeah. But at least we should stop the building of new buildings. I fought a one-man campaign, DeKalb, to prevent them from building. They're building a new school building with electrical heating here. And I did, you know, just toiling there and said, what are you thinking of? Their reason was as follows. They could not get natural gas. The gas company there is very leery about taking on any new commercial buildings, and they would not give them natural gas for this new school. And I don't know what really went into this, why the gas company suddenly decided but how do they decide who's going to get gas? If somebody builds a new store downtown, I bet they get natural gas, but they wouldn't get.
I have to work for a combination utility, normally, up to today, for instance, there's been an arbitrary decision based on size alone.
Size of it, yeah. That's probably right.
And so you can still normally get space heating for homes and small ventures, but you can only get natural gas for larger loads on an interruptible basis, and therefore you have to have an alternate fuel to the normal oil. And anybody who's going to put in a gas oil at the present time is looking at least in our geographic area, after 1978 on the natural gas company system, no gas, and so you'd be putting in at 75 the system that's going to be oil. Right. What I think I understand what you're saying is that you should match the use, that is, heating, low-grade heat source, and save the use electricity for lighting and other
more efficient to use.
But there is. This is a real world, too. And part of the real world is that you cannot physically run a business and say, I'll sell you your lighting at 2 cents a kilowatt hour, and I'll sell you your heating at 6 cents a kilowatt hour. You can't meter it.
I mean, right.
There's no way you can do it.
Well, but they're doing it now. They're selling the heating at a much lower rate. But what they do, at least for home usage, is they just say, well, you can only physically use up so much power and lighting, so everything you use over a certain amount we'll assume is electric heating, and we'll give it to you at a very...
You're talking 1969 prior, in my experience.
Our utility still has a preferential rate for space heating, electric space heating.
Where are you from?
Illinois. I wasn't aware of, you mentioned Vermont, now they've been away with it.
Oh, that's a pilot. I think was it a pilot? I got the
question. Most places still retain the preferential rate for space heating and even
you're using a word again, preferential. If you mean that the end block is lower in the rate schedule, and if that means preferential, the answer is yes.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean by preferential.
We have a predominantly... private electrical and gas businesses in this country.
Mm-hmm.
They're regulated by our government.
Mm-hmm.
They're regulated on a cost basis in most instances. And they're
but only a total. You can't tell me that it costs less to supply 100 kilowatts to a house than it does to supply 50 kilowatts to the house. Oh, I don't believe that. Because the utility company, the difference is minuscule. Because the utility company is limited by how much they can bring into a town or a neighborhood. But how it's distributed within that is just a matter of which direction the wires run. And you need so many transformers and so many poles. But to put in 500 ampere service instead of 100 ampere service is just a matter of a few dollars of copper, isn't it?
Could be, but normally the costs will run something like that. If you cut them off there and call those customer costs, the cost of the basic system, the poles, wires, and the metering, and the servicing of your account in this block, we would need about $4.80 a month for a residential customer to cover that.
Yeah.
That's there whether the guy's on vacation or not.
Minimum. The minimum bill. Right. That's the
okay.
thing. But now we're talking about...
When you say preferential, I assume that you would recognize this and then you would want that to be flat.
Yeah. Oh, sure. The minimum. Okay. That's a drop in the bucket. But I don't want this big break out here.
The way they're going now is, downward. But this line is picking up. In most utilities, current trend.
Because
those costs are changing.
Yeah.
The cost of new generation. Since 1968, for almost double.
Of course, what the power companies would like is a better time balance in the load,
right.
and that's certainly within the cards too.
We're involved. I happen to do electric rate work. I'm a lawyer, but I do that kind of work, and we're involved in a rate case in Minnesota now. The first case with a new commission. And we have interveners at Minnesota Energy Agency, who has hired Cheryl Schicchetti from Madison, and used to be Dylan Schicchetti, Gail New York, perspective on power. And they are advocating some type of time of day pricing.
Yeah.
We are advocating some type of time of day pricing, just because, and perhaps looking at it from two different ends of the tube. There's more in perhaps your theoretical area looking at it. Ours is from the standpoint that in 5 years we may be short of generation.
Yeah,
and we are one of the most stable companies in the country.
Yeah.
And so you've got, it's just a matter not only of brothers, but a matter of economics as well.
The time of day saves tremendously on generating equipment, but it's the saving in energy is very, very small. The only thing it prevents is the use of peaking generators. Now, at least Commonwealth uses mostly oil for peaking generators, and it would alleviate that. But the total energy use, of course, it won't help at all.
With your more stable, you can use your more efficient generator.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Now, that's the thing.
It saves the peaking.
Right.
Haven't the hot water heaters and some other things had some experimentation or some rates that are based on time of day or something?
The British have had this time of day space heating for years. When we were in living in England, we heated our house with what they call storage heaters, which are really just a pile of bricks with a heating element in them. So they'd run at night and then a few selected hours during the day. So you were nice and cozy warm in the morning, but by night it was getting kind of cold in the house. But it certainly certainly balanced the electrical load for the utilities beautifully.
I get the impression that
some of those communities that don't heat at all. That's the way to solve the problem.
Well, this is what they call central heating. It meant that all the electricity came from the same central place, as far as I can tell. We had one of these storage heaters in each room.
And perhaps you've done more in this area just because of traditional
balancing. But that still doesn't, of course, take care of the basic, you know, energy problem. It doesn't help. It helps the generating capacity.
But there ought to be more incentive for commercial institutions to conserve electricity.
Oh yeah, there's just none now.
You're right.
Yeah. Well, I hate to say, wait a minute, every time you say something, but there is the economic incentive that's involved in it running any business. And we find that our customers generally have this in mind. As the energy costs have gone higher, if they can't pass on that cost in the product, obviously they've got to do something.
Boy, there's been so little change, though,
and
in the industry.
There's going to be a much bigger change.
You bet.
You don't know when it's going to come. Yeah. But businesses are looking at it. They've done a lot with their lighting. We've got major customers dependent on oil that are looking at nighttime storage, using high cost, high grade electricity to heat up water in the evening. That's what our, unless we want to change our system, we've got a system that has a lot of checks and balances in it, and one of them is the cost, the price of the cost. Mm-hmm. And so
but one of the things, now you no doubt may not agree with this completely, but one of the problems with the electrical industry has been that they have not done any research and development. The research and development for the electrical power industry has been almost entirely government, at government expense. Well, even the suppliers are doing very, very little. Most the overwhelming development costs now of nuclear power have been borne by the taxpayer. And there'd be a whole different pricing structure and economic structure and everything throughout the electric utility industry if the electric power companies had to do the R&D on nuclear energy. Now, I don't think we'd have it, in fact, yet. So I'm all for the government doing R&D on power, but I'm for passing on some of that to the consumer. I would like to. I'd certainly like to see a universal energy tax. I've proposed that for a good many years.
Based on total energy use per family.
On all use of energy. Not only gasoline, but electricity as well. Well, the sales, I think maybe this is 1973 figures or something like that. The electrical sales in the country were something like $25 billion. You may have a more recent figure than that, I don't know. But supposing, almost any company, I'm sure Honeywell must put 1 to 1.5% of its gross revenues into research and development, maybe as high as 2% since it's a technologically oriented company. But if the electric power companies had been putting, say, 1% of their gross revenue into research and development for improving the product, that's $250 million a year. That would, we said the whole thermonuclear energy program has been funded at about $30 million a year. You know, that would have plowed an awful lot of money into research and development right along.
Well,
probably more efficiently too than the government does.
Pardon?
Probably more efficiently than the government has done too.
Possibly. There have been problems. I'm no defender of AEC policy. They've made a lot of mistakes, but it's the only way to job.
Right.
We'll get that now.
The impression that I got was that IRDA originally came out and said we were going to concentrate our efforts on the thermonuclear thing, and that now they've come out and said, hey, we're going to do thermonuclear and we're also going to do solar power.
I've never heard this, no. This is the first big, remember IRDA is only 6 months old.
Right.
And this is really the first major statement from IRDA. Now, AEC had a policy, but of course this again wasn't AEC's doing. Nixon's first energy budget message, 5 or 6 years ago, made the flat statement, and there are an awful lot of us that thought, oh my gosh, what is it, who has set him up to this? The major effort in research and development was going to the breeder. That was it, period.
Okay, I guess that's probably what I'm referring
to. And that was by presidential order about five, six years ago. And I think that set the energy R&D program back a long way, because this meant AEC, when the president says this is what's going to be, why AEC has to follow suit. And so we did put all our eggs in one basket. That was the breeder basket. And it's only, as I say, in the last 2 years that the CTR program has gotten any support to speak of at all. And solar energy still hasn't. It's just now in the new IRDA budget. Let's see. Let's look at the proposed IRDA budget, which, of course, has to go through many. It has to go through many filters, and Congress may whack away with it. All right. This is the 1976 R&D. This is just R&D, of course, not building demonstration plants or anything of the sort. All right. We'll take the president's budget message plus the recommended supplements now that IRDA has recommended that may go through Congress. Fossil energy, that is be principally coal, had 391 plus the 26 supplement would be about 415 $450 million. Solar now was in the president's message appeared as 70, and IRDA's asking for 19 more, so this would be 89 million, which is a tremendous increase from what it's been. Geothermal, the president's message was in at 24, if the increase is granted, what IRDA's asking is 32. And just other advanced energy systems, including, tidal, everything else, would be $44 million. Conservation, and incidentally, conservation is more than just, asking everybody to turn out the lights. There's a lot of technology that goes into that. And the biggest single thing in conservation, in my opinion, is attacking the whole transportation problem. We'll talk about this tomorrow. How do you move people? Because you can conserve a tremendous amount of energy if you can change the way people move by.